Two or Three Witnesses by C. E. Montagu. 1. Thanks to our spirited press, the eyes and the ears of the English nation are everywhere. Still, there may be, at any one time, more of these organs on one patch of ground than another. In all Connaught, there were, at the time I am telling of, only 4 pairs of each. They were set in the heads of 4 London journalists, now taking their ease in their inn at the small town of Callow, after the labours of the day. These labours had ended at 6. They had had to. The travelling assistant press censor from Dublin had ordered it so. Devil a word, he had said, would he take for the wire a moment later than 6. And it Christmas Day in a week's time, and the girl at the post office having a long way to walk to her home in the darkness of the night. The doyen of the 4 correspondents was Pellet, who wrote for The Day. Pellet liked to be called the doyen. His paper, he said, was the doyen of papers. When first he had heard of that absurd 6 o'clock rule, Pellet had taken pity upon its author, had gone at once to see him alone and let him know what was what. The whole of the great world, as Pellet explained, all the people who counted, read The Day. If any parcel of a country's history did not duly impinge at the time on the consciousness of the world, that parcel of history could hardly be said to exist. At most, it had only the shadowy, problematic existence of some orchid that might or might not have bloomed in some unexplored equatorial forest with no one to see. Had the assistant censor no love of his country? At any rate, he had no vision. His mind was provincial. Weren't there 4 of them in it, he asked, and not Pellet only? Every dog had his day. Once give a favour, and soon there'd be copy pouring into the place till God knew what hour. Whereas any post office clerk that you'd see was a human creature the like of ourselves. So 6 o'clock it had been on this, the first day of the 4 pressmen's labours at Callow. It would be 6 o'clock tomorrow as well. This was graver. Tomorrow was going to be a big day. Thomas Curtain, greatest of Irishmen, was to be buried in homely state at his birthplace, Kilmullen, a village some 20 miles off. Here was a sob story chance, manifestly. The London papers were wanting to feature the rite. Curtain's historic manner of giving old England a fugitive dig, now in the back and now in the stomach, during the pre-treaty years, had caught the fancy of our dispassionate nature of amateurs of the ring. Every correspondent would have to be there, and then he would have to be copious and vivid, crisp and magnanimous, right up to 6. 2. Still, for the moment, the 4 were at ease. Or 3 of them were. The 4th, Fane, the raw hand, was better off than at ease. His spirits were in a heavenly whirl. This was his first biggish job, and he thrilled with delight at everything that it brought. Every hurry or makeshift or jar or rebuff was adventure. Merely to sit there and hear the tremendous shop talked by the 3 middle-aged men who knew all was initiation. It gave him the raptures of swift, conscious growth. They were humane to him. Dinner, which they had allowed to be sound in the vital matters of claret and game, had been followed by bridge. "Not bad bridge either, considering," Pellet admitted after the last trick had fallen, while casting a disciplinary look at Fane from under his ponderous brows. Fane's failings were clearly the considerations referred to. Morris, his partner, had snubbed Fane's admissions and pleas after each ill-starred flutter of their common cause, with repetitions of the formula, "Correct mistakes and carry on," in tones of firm resignation. Fane felt that he had played like a conscript, but then he had been one, had only wanted for his part to look round Callow, to gorge himself with its quaint queerness. Still, everyone else's escape from an evening of pain had seemed to depend on his cutting in. So he had played. But now, while Morris and Bute totted up, he could give himself without shame to the amusement of eyeing the room, so much more purely and deeply mid-Victorian in every colour and curve of its fittings and furniture than any room now to be easily found in fashion-following England. Odd that on Rebel Island an older England should stamp her most durable image. Savoursome Tudor idioms were constantly piquing one's ear.